You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, which matters more to you, siding with a politician or with the issues themselves? We'll find out how people's minds can change when they find out where high-profile political leaders stand on issues. Now, a new report looks into the data for a trend that's familiar to a lot of people in the state, population decline in rural areas. The numbers from the Wisconsin-based research group Forward Analytics show that between 2010 and 2018, two-thirds of the state's rural counties lost population. It's the first time rural areas have seen this overall decline in the past three decades. Rob Mentzer is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Thanks.
Well, this report from Forward Analytics found that a lot of Wisconsin's rural counties lost population from 2010 to 2018. Give us the basics. First of all, tell us what they mean when they say rural county.
Right. So you have to sort of define what you're talking about with when you say rural. And so the census looks at, first of all, there are metropolitan areas. Those are big cities. Those are out. They also define counties that have a micropolitan area, which is like a city but under 50,000 people. And then they define counties that have neither, a big city nor a small city. So this report looked at both at those that had neither, the sort of purely rural counties, as well as counties that did have a small city, like those micropolitan counties.
What were some of the counties then that were hardest hit by population loss?
Pretty bad in the North Woods. The largest was population loss was Price County, which lost more than 5% of its population over the 8 years studied, 2010 to 2018. Iron County was over 4%. The average, like most of the counties that did experience population loss, about two-thirds of the rural counties in Wisconsin did. The average was around 2%. There were some that barely lost any, but of course, when the rest of the population is growing, if you're just sort of holding steady, you're relatively speaking still losing ground.
Now, we heard from Diana on Facebook who said, what comes first for taking care of your family is health care. You have to find a good job that provides it or pays well enough that you can provide for it. She gives us a couple issues there, Rob. Let's start with that job. How does the economic outlook, according to this report, tie in with this population decline in so many counties?
Well, there's no question about it that is a large driver in any study. When you're looking at data, you sort of start the clock in 2010 to 2018. You're looking at the Great Recession and it's sort of in the aftermath of that, right? And all evidence is that it hit rural communities hard and drove a lot of migration out of rural areas into urban areas. Presumably, you know, at least one large factor is because people are seeking work. The other thing that can happen is if population is declining, it can create the sort of vicious circle, right? Where if a company, say a manufacturing company, window manufacturers in the North Woods or something, are having trouble hiring, then they ultimately have to make the decision to leave that rural community and move to a larger city where they may have a larger workforce to draw from. But then that has the effect of making it more likely that people have to then move and follow those jobs.
And Diana mentioned health care, too. I don't think the report tackled this in particular. But Rob, I hear again and again for many rural communities, we don't have particular kinds of specialists within a close distance. We don't have particular kinds of mental health or addiction treatment. Just from your vantage point there, covering a lot of rural Wisconsin, do you see that as a concern that might be part of this story?
I think it is certainly part of the story, and yeah, while I would hesitate to put a number on it, it is something that you hear again and again. Access to healthcare and rural healthcare is a real hurdle and a challenge that the healthcare providers are trying to find ways to network and you know whatever address. So I think that it requires more study, let's say, but it'd be crazy to think that it is not a factor here.
Talking to Rob Mentzer, WPR Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau, looking at a new report that finds a population decline in many Wisconsin rural counties. And Rob, we've got a big census, of course, coming up this year. It's going to give us new and I think more precise data. Is there an expectation from the report authors that this trend of declining rural population is going to continue?
There is an expectation that the trend is going to continue. And now, of course, so Wisconsin as a whole, its population is growing just very slowly. It can't compare. When you talk about the census, Wisconsin will not have the type of growth that is being seen in the sort of, you know, southwestern United States and other sort of high growth areas. But Wisconsin's population has been growing. That's sort of what the consensus is. So this is really focused on the rural areas. That same thing could have been said about Wisconsin's rural communities as recently as the 2010s. They were experiencing positive growth, according to this study, of over 3% in the 2010s. Now, they were outpaced by Wisconsin cities by a lot, by more than twice as fast, but they were still growing. Then after 2010, from 2010 to 2018, that's when these communities have actually entered into negative territory and on average were shrinking in population. And that's where the serious economic impacts and follow-on impacts come.
Another possible follow-on impact that I think you've looked at in the past, Rob, has to do with school districts. We've seen over the years talk of consolidating school districts, communities having to close, say, the elementary school, all tied to this issue of there aren't enough people and especially there aren't enough kids to sustain them.
That's right. Yes, this is something that it's not so dissimilar to the healthcare challenge, right? As in sparsely populated areas, as there are fewer people, it's hard to sustain the types of institutions in the communities that were, you know, existed when there were more people. And schools are a big part of that, and elementary schools in particular, because the rural populations are also aging. There are just fewer children in many of these communities. And so elementary schools are a major area where you see an impact. So, you know, for example, I got data from the Department of Public Instruction that said that since 2011, 71 schools in rural areas have closed, and 40 of those were in elementary, were at the elementary level. And that is a trend that is seen in different regions of the state, across the state, in rural areas, and one that I don't think anybody has a great solution for.
Rob, were there outlier counties that bucked this overall trend?
Well, one thing yes, it should be said that there's population decline in about two-thirds of Wisconsin's rural counties, which means one-third of the counties did not have population decline. One area where that seems to work better for rural areas is places that do have these micropolitan counties. You know, Portage County had population growth over the period studied, and quite a significant, almost over 9% job growth in that time. Portage County, of course, is where Stevens Point is located. Stevens Point has a university, and it has a number of large employers, industries there. And so they're more insulated from the types of trends that are seen in a more what you would call a pure rural counties. So that's one. Another thing that is seen is rural counties that can serve as sort of bedroom communities or become sort of exurban areas to larger metropolitan areas tend to have better economic outcomes. That's a hard – like it's like – what do you do with that? You know what I mean? If you don't happen to be located near a larger city, I don't know how that helps, but that does seem to be evident in the data.
Rob, thanks a lot for bringing this to us today.
Thank you so much.
Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. He talked with us about a new report from the group Forward Analytics that found that between 2010 and 2018, two-thirds of Wisconsin's rural counties saw a decline in their population. Coming up, for the first time in Academy Awards history, a film not in English took home Best Picture. We'll get the details and talk about what that could say about the direction of movies in America. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, for the first time in the history of the Academy Awards, the Best Picture Award was given to a film that's not in English. We'll talk about what that win means for the film and for future Oscars. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's former host and executive producer Erica Janik with a story about an iconic Wisconsin record company.
To sell its phonographic cabinets, a Grafton furniture business decided to start a record label. It became one of the leading producers of blues records in the 1920s and made pioneering recordings of some of the nation's great musicians. Sergio Gonzalez tells us the story of Paramount Records as part of Wisconsin 101.
The first time we heard about this was because Jack White's production company had just put out this huge collection of Paramount records. And so the first thing I heard was not the blues music. It was some of this quote-unquote ethnic music of Southern and Eastern European. The first time I heard it, I was like, this is not good. What is this? Like, why would people listen to this? You know, it didn't sound like anything special or particular. And it wasn't until you get to the blues that you really understood what made Paramount special. It was strictly a money-making project. So the Wisconsin Chair Company was founded in the 1880s, and they were really successful in Port Washington creating things like beds and cabinets. But with the introduction of phonographs in the late 19th and early 20th century, they decided to jump into that business. And they were making phonographic cabinets for corporations like the Edison Company. And they got to thinking, well, if we're making these phonographic cabinets, why don't we just start making some music as well? So they had purchased two different subsidiaries that had kind of ventured into the blues market, so Puritan Records and the New York Recording Laboratories. And really the thing that pushed them into the blues market was the hiring of J. Mayo Williams. He was a guy who was living in Chicago, and he had actually contacted this company and asked if he could be a talent recruiter for them. And he had a very special talent of finding unknown artists in the South and then bringing up to Chicago and eventually all the way up to Wisconsin to record music. So some of the big recorders, you had Louis Armstrong, Jelly Roll Morton, Ethel Waters, and Ma Rainey. But the big find for J. Mayo Williams is Blind Lemon Jefferson. Grafton plant was made specifically to make cheap music. Artists would come all the way up from the South, stop in Grafton, and then because of the sundown laws in Grafton, would have to leave the city as African-American artists and head back to Milwaukee to find a place to stay. Paramount blew up in the 1920s, up until basically the Great Depression, where the entire music industry collapsed. At its height, the Wisconsin Chair Company employed 1/6 of all workers in Ozaukee County. And so they were a touchstone organization within the community. And so I would imagine a lot of people understood that company kind of being instrumental to, you know, their family's well-being. Like a lot of companies, Paramount Records did not treat their talent with a lot of respect, and specifically their black artists. They were paid considerably less than the rest of their artists on their slates. And so records show that 9 out of 10 Paramount recording artists never received any royalties from their music, and a lot of them were swindled out of the copyrights on their songs. And so they would write these fantastic songs, and Paramount would hold the rights to them, and the artists would never see really any profit off of that. Paramount records to this day are really hard to find because they were produced on these cheap wax masters that were made for immediate production but not made to last very long. And so people who purchased Paramount records knew that they were going to get great music but not very good quality. I think the amazing story about Paramount is that we're talking about one of the most important companies in the creation of blues music in the 1920s and early 1930s. And it was based here in Wisconsin, in a place that people wouldn't even think about.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik. Get this black sexy.
Now, at last night's Academy Awards, the movie Parasite took home Best Picture, making history as the first foreign language film to do so. Parasite was nominated for 6 awards and walked away with 4 Best Picture, Best International Feature Film, Best Directing, and Best Original Screenplay. Let's take a listen to the South Korean director, Bong Joon-ho, accepting the Best Screenplay Award. You'll hear him first speak in Korean and then his translator.
Well, 시나리오를 쓴다는 게 사실 뭐 되게 고독하고 외로운 작업이죠. 사실 뭐 국가를 대표해서 시나리오를 쓰는 건 아닌데. 예.
Writing a script is always such a lonely process. We never write to represent our countries.
But this is very first Oscar to South Korea. Thank you.
Reggie Ponder reviews movies as Reggie the Real Critic. He appears weekly on Vocalo Radio in Chicago and critiques movies for several other media outlets. Reggie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, before we get to the award, Reggie, tell us about this film. It's not something that's been, you know, blockbuster box office. For people who haven't checked it out yet, give us a taste.
Yeah, so this is one of those films that you don't want to tell a lot about because you do want to go into this one with a fresh slate. So I'll try to keep it as short as possible. But this is really about a poor family trying to move up in life and do it at the cost of all other people. And what happens is this family, the Kim family, the son of the Kim family gets a really prestigious job working for a rich family, and he figures out a way to get the rest of his family to work for that family as well. There's a lot of ins and outs here, but this is really about a socioeconomic injustice film about poor versus rich, how they look at each other, how they view each other, and some of the ins and outs of trying to come up, if you will.
And director Bong Joon-ho apparently has described it as a comedy without clowns, a tragedy without villains. It sounds like it's a little hard to categorize that way.
Yeah, it is very hard to categorize. You will find yourself, well, some of the things to like about this is this is a poor man's story, so you will either root for the Kim family or you'll watch it hoping that it will all fall apart, and it almost like if you were watching a big car wreck. And the story, the plot is really interesting. It has some nice little twists and turns to it. You don't really actually know where it's going. And it says a lot about social status, the rich versus the poor. They have some profound messages and questions in this film.
Now that takes us to last night and Parasite becoming the first non-English language film to take home the Best Picture Award. What do you think about that?
So I think that they got it right. This was my film of the year. I think that they really did pick the best picture. I know a lot of people were rooting for 1917. That movie was a great achievement in cinematography and movie making, but Parasite was really that film that I ask myself this, and I say this to you all the time, Rob, is that would I go and see the movie again? 1917, not so much. Parasite, absolutely yes. And then the fact that people would sit and watch a movie with subtitles says something about that film. It says a lot about the directing, the writing, just the overall presentation of the film. And I will tell you this as well. This is a film for me that I like watching people watch it. It's like looking at their reaction. So they absolutely got it right. And I'm so happy for this film.
People have said the Oscars have been shy about subtitles in the past. Do you think there's a case there?
Yeah. I understand because you do miss something when you're watching, when you're reading subtitles, because you don't get this. You're looking at the bottom of the screen, and there might be some nuances and some things that you miss when you're watching a movie that has subtitles. So sometimes you might even watch it again just so you don't miss some of the stuff that you would normally see by using your eyes.
After an Oscar win, a lot of movies will show up at theaters again, or maybe even in more theaters than in their first run. Reggie, is this one that we benefit from going to see on the big screen as opposed to saying, I'll just catch up with it at home?
Yeah, I think yes, because I think one of the things about going to the movies is there's this atmosphere and the participation of the other people in the film, and you will find yourself talking to the screen on this one, like, oh no, don't do it, and you'll be gasping and all the other types of actions that you have when you're with a crowd. It'll take on a kind of a different type of atmosphere than just watching this one at home.
Bong Joon-ho, the director of Parasite, also directed the movie The Host. It became the highest-grossing South Korean film when it came out. What else should we look for in his work if we're into Parasite?
Well, if you're into Parasite, he is now doing a miniseries, I think, on Netflix as it relates to this film. So I am totally looking forward to seeing this. And if you've already seen Parasite, he's coming out with a black and white version of this movie as well. So this is really interesting. What I do want to mention, I think you might be asking me about this, Rob, is the fact that while the Academy got it right, they also got something dreadfully wrong. How can you have a movie that is the best picture, best foreign film, best director, best original screenplay, and none of the actors are nominated? Not one?
Yeah, what's up with that, do you think?
So here's what happens with the Academy, is that you get voted in by your peers. So the directors recognize, oh, wow, this is a great film. And so they voted it in for the best director. The screenwriters thought it was a great film. So they vote, but the actors did not vote it in. And this says something about Hollywood and the reflection of themselves that the actors want to see. So I wouldn't get totally excited about that this is going to set a trend for foreign films. I think it will be a boost to the foreign film industry in that some foreign films might get a second look, but I don't see this as being some type of trend. I see that this film was head and shoulders above the rest, in my opinion, and it should have won, and the voters did that. But I think they absolutely did a disservice to Asian talent as it relates to nominating some of these actors for an Academy Award as well.
Well, do you see yourself, Reggie, maybe pursuing some of the actors in Parasite, looking at what else they've been in, and, you know, just like we could follow the director, seeing them work in other films?
I do, but I will tell you that I don't love reading subtitles. So the movie really has to be a phenomenal movie for me to sit through that, because it does kind of, again, takes away a little bit something from the movie going experience for me. So I will look to see what these actors have done. But right now I'm just relishing in the fact that the Academy got it right, Rob. This is an excellent film, and I am absolutely hoping that people will go and see this film. And I want to say one other thing. The reason that this is an excellent film is because I think this is a film that people, regular people, can identify with.
Reggie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Reggie Ponder, a.k.a. Reggie the Real Critic, looking at Parasite's big win at the Oscars yesterday. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Keeley Baltina continues a series of interviews with the candidates in Wisconsin's Supreme Court primary election. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, has been the topic of conversation and debate since former President Obama signed it into law in 2010. In 2013, TV host Jimmy Kimmel did a gag experiment of on-the-street interviews to illustrate how people's opinion of the legislation could have less to do with its contents than the name.
We're talking about health care today, and which plan do you support, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act.
And what is it about Obamacare that you do not like?
I just think that there's a lot of holes in it, and it needs to be revamped. I think it's
and you think
it hasn't
the affordable,
been thought out.
You think the Affordable Care Act is a better plan than Obamacare?
Better, but I'm not happy with that either.
What do you agree with?
The clip goes on to show several people with similar responses, not aware that the two plans being mentioned are in fact the same thing. The concept that voters may be persuaded to change their minds on issues based on the politicians who support them has some new data to support it. Milwaukee native John Turris is a professor of political science at LaGrange College in Georgia. He looked at some of this new data in a recent article he wrote for The Conversation titled Americans on the Right and Left Change Their Minds After Hearing Where Trump Stands. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you have me on here. And it's as someone who's born in Wisconsin, happy to be in touch there.
Yes, but not in the weather, maybe. It's a bit chilly.
I've heard it's even colder up there than down here.
Now, before we get into these newer polls, I understand you've used this Jimmy Kimmel bit in your classroom before. What makes this kind of a teachable example?
I think it shows for the students, you know, something that's very relatable for someone taking their first political science course, how somebody's name can probably change support for or against it. There's one I didn't mention because I was struggling to find the source, but I can remember the private Social Security debate, like whether or not you should privatize some of it. And they had young voters were actually interested in privatizing Social Security. They liked the concept. But when they heard it was George W. Bush's idea, support for it plummeted because he was pretty unpopular at the time.
That takes us to this new information that you wrote about, polls on President Trump and different issues and how people's opinions of those issues changed. What kind of data do we have out there?
Okay. You'll remember about, it seems like almost an eternity ago, but it was just a short time ago, there was a U.S. drone strike that killed the leader or one of the key people in the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. So Yahoo News YouGov asked a poll saying, should America take additional military action? This is after we had killed him and there was a retaliation from Iran that struck a U.S. base in Iraq. So 50% said no, including 70% of Democrats. Only 37% of Republicans agreed that that there should be airstrikes. Or excuse me, 37% of Republicans said that we should restrain ourselves from attacking.
Right.
Now, when they found it was Donald Trump's idea, the support among Republicans jumped from 37% to over 80%. And support among Democrats for restraint dropped from 70% down to 58%.
So there was a change on both sides after either side heard what President Trump's policy was. Republicans were more likely to support that idea. Democrats were more likely to oppose it. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah. So this means something. It seems like what?
Oh, my gosh. It's well, I mean, it shows that the you know, just when you start trying to decide how do voters decide. In the past, we might think when partisan affiliations were strong that being a Republican or being a Democrat meant something. Now it seems like people are orienting themselves whether Trump supports something or not.
Right. And can you think of past political personalities who may have had that impact? I mean, with that Obamacare example, some people who liked the president might have liked that phrase, Obamacare being attached to the Affordable Care Act. People opposed him. Do you think President Trump is unique in this way, though?
Let's put it this way. In the case of Obamacare versus Affordable Care Act, when I looked at the numbers, there would probably be about a 10 to 15 point swing either in favor from Affordable Care Act to Obamacare among supporters of Obama and maybe 10 to 15 points opposed when they heard that the Affordable Care Act was the same as Obamacare. But this, I mean, a 50-point swing is unprecedented. I've never seen anything like this.
Talking to John Turris, professor of political science at LaGrange College, looking at how President Trump's support for an issue can change attitudes among voters on either side. People who like him like the issue more. People who don't like him like it less. Do we have much more data on this? Is this something that people try to research a lot?
Believe it or not, I found this quite by accident because the lead story was in the same poll. They were trying to compare Obama's policy on Iran to Trump's policy on Iran. And the big headline said Obama's policy is more popular among voters than Trump's policy. And I started scrolling down and I found this buried near the bottom. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is a much bigger story. It shows, you know, kind of people breaking away from partisan labels and even ideology. You know, if somebody's basically saying among a Republican, oh, I think we should hit him back. Oh, wait, President Trump's against it. OK, we should not hit them back. And I will say this, and I'm kind of jumping on in, but a lot of times people will, when they respond to my columns, they will take a stand and sometimes not realize, I'll inform them when it's Trump's position, they change their own minds. So I see this on an individual basis, not just in polls.
Interesting. So let's talk about a little bit of our political history. As you mentioned, maybe that partisan affiliation might shape our attitudes more in the past. What did that look like? How did we sort ourselves out politically based on party?
It's interesting that you meant or that you brought up the idea of sorting ourselves based on party, because that used to be one of the strongest predictors of whether someone was going to vote and what candidates they were going to vote for. And now it seems like they're shifting from support for party to support of the individual president, whatever stand they take.
So what is it about President Trump that in particular has this this kind of radical break with what we've seen in the past?
I would say his polarizing nature. I mean, it seems like he engenders not only super strong loyalty, like the kind we haven't seen in a long time, you know, devotion to this leader, versus also kind of strong anger opposing him, which is probably explaining why Democrats backed off the policy of restraint, just because they didn't want to be affiliated with Trump.
Now, in your piece, you also reference a study from the Royal Society in March of 2017. They published it that looked into how people actually process true and false information and whether they determine it to be credible or not based on who it's attributed to. What do we learn from that?
Okay. In that study, this is the experiment where they said, okay, here are a series of phrases that came out. And Republicans and Democrats didn't differ very much. But when they heard that Trump was supportive of a statement like vaccines cause autism or something like that, then Democrats were far likely to be against it and Republicans were far more likely to support it.
Interesting. And these weren't necessarily things that President Trump was in real life for or against. Do I have that right?
That is the case. I haven't seen him make some of the statements that were on there, but they were just testing people just to see how strong their ties to Trump were or not.
Well, now we've got an election year here with this information in hand. I mean, this what does this tell you about what you're watching for in this political campaign?
I did see something in an article today which said Democrats need to get President Trump out of their head. And I think one of the things that hurt them in 2016, it would hurt them in 2020, is if you make the election all about Trump, if you make it a referendum about Trump. I think one of the weaknesses the Democrats had last time, and certainly, I mean, your state is much covered down here, even in Georgia, just how close it was in Wisconsin. You need to almost not ignore, but just kind of sideline the issue, say, here's your opposition, but focus more on what you're going to do. I think a clear plan saying this is what we're going to have. I don't think FDR does as well against Herbert Hoover. I mean, he still probably wins. But FDR does better by having a plan of action rather than my entire policy is going to be I'm not Herbert Hoover.
But I wonder, whatever the Democratic message is, if there's a lot of people already out there saying, hey, I'm with Trump no matter what, and I'll follow him from issue to issue. Does that mean we're unpersuadable on either side of the political spectrum?
Oh, I think his numbers are pretty low for a president seeking reelection. They may rise over time, but I mean, they've been consistently mired in the upper 30s to low 40s. So this is a pretty winnable election. I just don't think it's going to generate a lot of turnout if all it becomes is a shouting match about Trump. Democrats would do well to have a simple, straightforward plan saying this is what we're going to do when we take over, because otherwise, what's it, better the devil you know rather than the devil you don't know. That's how some voters might react and either stay home or even vote for a third party or something else.
We're talking to political science professor John Turris from LaGrange College about studies that show that people change their political views, their views on a particular policy or issue, based on whether President Trump supports that issue or not. And it happens for critics of President Trump. They're less likely to support that issue. His supporters become more likely if they find out that he supported it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this describe you? Have you changed your mind about an issue after hearing that Trump supports it or doesn't support it? Has this been the case for you with other presidents or politicians? If you think this is not you, but you see it happening around you, friends, family, coworkers, the people on social media, however you know them, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about voters from the right and left switching their sides on issues, their attitudes on issues after they hear where President Trump stands. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these findings? Do you think President Trump is unique in this way, or do you see past politicians who you think people line themselves up for or against and aligned their attitudes on issues to follow their attitude toward that particular individual? What does this make you think of the future of political parties and their power versus individuals who may or may not go along with the party's traditional values? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest, using the example of the person on the street interviews with Obamacare versus the Affordable Care Act, is it a question of political affiliation, or is it really a question of how well educated these people are on the issues?
Tom, thanks for the call. John, I don't know if we have data on this, but your thoughts on that?
That is a good question, I think, and it may well be that after budget cutbacks, after going to No Child Left Behind Act and standardized tests, that people really don't know as much about policy. I was going to give an example earlier. I wrote a column about Alan Dershowitz and his position, and a person emailed me and said, "Oh, that is the stupidest argument ever made. I'm gonna quit subscribing to this newspaper. I can't believe he gave such an argument." And he wrote out the argument, and I said, "Well, that's the quote I gave to Alan Dershowitz." And this guy, who's a traditional supporter of Trump, said, "Oh," and then shortly after he started defending Dershowitz's argument, the same one he said was stupid. So there is a little bit of people going nose blind when it comes to these issues.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. John, I think sometimes in the media world, and I think maybe in the political science world, there's the model of the voter carefully considering the issues and where they stand on the issues and then coming up with this rational decision on who to vote for. But it seems like there's always been a lot more going on than that. Just our gut, our assessment of a candidate's personality. We're never just, no matter how educated we are, rational voters, are we?
As a political scientist, I would hope that everybody's a rational voter, that they make their decisions educated, et cetera. But you are correct that a lot of times people do make their emotions based on like how the person looks. We've heard stories about how tall they are. An interesting test we're going to get came out today when Trump talked about putting together his proposed budget, and people have seen his $4.8 trillion budget, and it's going to have cuts in Medicare and Social Security, and that's something he left untouched, which helped him in 2016 in the GOP primary. We're about to see how people feel about Medicare and Social Security.
Let's go back to our callers. Jim is with us in Appleton. Jim, hello.
Hello. As a voter, I'm just amazed that the people even vote for Republicans and Democrats. And the way both parties have been behaving of late is just pathetic. And one that really got me is when the Democrats started saying they're for free trade. If you go back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it was the Democrats were the ones that hollered for fair trade, and Republicans are hollering for free trade. And maybe you guys aren't old enough to remember that, but I do.
Jim, thanks for the call. And yeah, there have been those kind of changes over the years. Jim frustrated with both parties, though, John, and he's saying they're not necessarily consistent.
I think there's a strong argument you made about free trade as being an issue that whipped all around. And yes, consistently you had Democrats oppose free trade, being pro-union. And I think that changed because Bill Clinton sought an opportunity that he could get some new Democrat votes or new Democratic Party votes by appealing more to business and triangulating the policy. And so therefore he was able to get a lot of free trade policies in. But I think I agree, at the cost of unions being left behind, that's why there's so much support for Bernie Sanders within the party.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Superior. Tom, hello.
Hi. Yeah, this has always been a concern for me. It went back to when I seen the way the media was framing the Obamacare versus the ACA and how people were falling victim to their biases on that. I'm just wondering what kind of is the main driving force? Is it just the acceleration of hyper-partisan media or what? But I noticed a strange change when Trump entered office. Like, it's not just political parties, it's groups like religious groups as well. I noticed the evangelicals prior to Trump's election, they said that upwards of 80% of them said strong ethics and morality were important to them. Now I think that number's dropped to something like 20%. I was just kind of, I'm just at a loss for what's creating the deeper and deeper divide as years go on.
Tom, thanks for the call. John, any thoughts?
I don't think that the media is being partisan. I mean, we certainly have networks that have their partisan biases or so that lean one way or the other. But I think that some of this comes down to simplification for the media. And you can take shots at me because even though I'm a professor, I'm also a member of the media. And this isn't done, by the way, by public radio, which is why I listen to a lot of public radio. I'm not just on the show, but I'm also a listener. If you go to a lot of current media today, there seems to be this focus on, let's focus on the individual and the person and the personality. So we make everything about Trump, everything about Obama, everything about Bush, and not as much about here are the issue positions.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We're talking to John Turris from LaGrange College in Georgia, looking at a piece he wrote titled Americans on the Right and Left Change Their Minds After Hearing Where Trump Stands. Back to your calls. Troy joins us now in Appleton. Troy, hi.
Hi. I believe you guys hit the nail on the head with the idea that people are extremely uninformed or undereducated when it comes to politics and policies and the understandings. Even when they implemented quote, Obamacare, to me, it was I had a coworker that didn't even understand that his daughter was able to still receive his insurance till 26. And she was racking up bills like crazy. And just the idea of, you know, how much can the president actually influence the finances, the financial, he says policies, but, you know, the Federal Reserve and many other things actually, you know, control the economy itself. I feel that people are extremely...
Gotcha, Troy. I'm going to jump in. John, what do you think? Troy, referring to something that an earlier caller brought up, we don't know enough about the policies out there maybe to make informed decisions about them.
Yeah, Troy, I think that's a good idea. And all the callers, by the way, I really appreciate your calls. This is like a challenging classroom, if you think about it, where we're all trying to learn from this. I'm testing out my students tomorrow with a project. I don't know if you refer to or you're aware of a group called I Side With, but I'm going to have my students write down, okay, which candidate do they support? And then they're going to take this I Side With quiz where it doesn't focus on the people. It focuses on the issue.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Where do you stand on gun rights? Where do you stand on the economy? Where do you stand on foreign policy? Where do you stand on the environment? And then it gives you a match, like which candidates best match with you. So I call it match.com study. I did this before every 4 years with classes, and I usually find that students think they support one candidate, and then when they run one of these I Side With, they find another candidate actually is much more closely matched to them. And believe it or not, the same thing happened with me. I thought there was a candidate that I was the most in sync with, and there was someone else who took over that spot.
Time for one more quick call. James is with us in Crandon. James, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think that Trump's going to have a harder sale now with the cuts into Medicare or Social Security and other benefits. I'm a big Trump supporter, but this could be a hard sell.
James, thanks for that call. So a self-identified Trump supporter there, John, saying there are at least a couple policy lines that he would not follow the president over.
The big difference, I think, for Trump in winning 2016, somebody would say, oh, it's his Twitter. Oh, it's his insulting nicknames. Oh, it's his brash style. It's the fact that he was on TV and a reality show personality. I think one thing separated him from a lot of others is he really wanted to preserve, or at least publicly talked about preserving Medicare and Social Security. And his opponents were all thinking about how to cut it. Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, traditional conservatives. By cutting into that, Trump is gambling that, well, I own the Republican Party, so I won't get opposition there. And Democrats don't like me either. But I think that will turn off not only independents, but also Republicans.
Thanks to John Turris for joining us today from LaGrange College in Georgia. His piece in The Conversation was titled Americans on the Right and Left Change Their Minds After Hearing Where Trump Stands. Tomorrow on Central Time, the impeachment process was designed before two-party politics existed. Our guest says that's a problem because those two systems don't work together very well. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Keeley and her guests talk about the ways we deal with grief in our lives in the short and long runs. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear from the author of a recent love letter to the family landline and talk about how we could preserve some of what we loved about it in the era of cell phones. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.